Hi, and welcome to The Foxhole, a show that brings you insights into hot topics, lifestyle design tips, and tactics for success.
So I kind of understood. I sort of understand the background to all of this. I'm not really a big sports or gambling guy, so this is a little bit outside of my wheelhouse. But what happened was the Supreme Court reversed or like struck down a law basically that banned sports gambling outside of Nevada. Like what was the situation before the Supreme Court pulled this back?
Okay, so, and we're talking about the Supreme Court striking down the federal law prohibiting sports gambling. So there was a law that was in place that prohibited sports gambling that allowed only Nevada to do this.
So in this article, I think one of the things that the concerns from the sort of pro sports side of the equation, I think, was about the integrity of the games themselves.
Supposedly.
So could that be the reason that they wanted this law in place? Because they don't want there to be an incentive for cheating and elements like that?
That's what they're saying. But the reality is that sports betting is huge, and it's going on already with or without this law.
$150 billion. So they said that the amount of money bet on professional sports in Nevada is, what, just under $5 billion per year, where the illegal gambling market for this stuff is $150 billion per year?
Exactly. You know, because it's already happening, I don't know that their argument about integrity is necessarily valid.
Yeah, I mean, it's already happening in Nevada, right? So,
well, it's happening in Nevada legally, but it's happening all over the world through offshore sports betting, online sports betting. I mean, there's hundreds and thousands of websites where you can go on. Like, you right now could literally go on a website, get an account, and start doing sports betting. And your money would be going through some offshore company. It's probably maybe not, I don't know, probably not legal, or however they set it up. And then there's always, like, you know, they get their fees. And it's basically organized crime. So who knows, like, how the cards will fall. What's going to happen is the government has an opportunity, if they want, to create laws around all of this, which I'm sure everyone will really enjoy that. Or if they don't, then each state will individually create their own laws and how they want to be involved or not be involved in this.
I don't understand at all why this is controversial. Like, I wish I understood, like, why they put that law in place in 92 to prevent this from being a thing, because it seems like it'd be massive, especially because there's also, I mean, it kind of dovetails with esports a little bit too, because with the rise of esports and betting on esports, that's a big area of interest also. And I just wish I understood. Because I guess other states, I mean, is it just about gambling? Is that why? Like, do other states have strict gambling laws?
Well, you can't gamble in most states unless you're on an Indian reservation.
So that is true then, huh? So it's really just about gambling. Is that the problem? It's not so much that it's related to sports. It's just like gambling as an issue is what they wanted to legislate against.
No, I mean, that's not what they're saying. That's not what, like, the NBA and the NCAA, they're all saying it's about, you know, integrity and keeping things on the up and up. But that might be a better argument. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's too soon to say exactly what's going to happen. It's kind of like, you know, I saw some people tweeting actually about it being about that, individual opinions, like, oh, now everyone's going to be, gambling's already such a huge thing and there's going to be more people with addictions and blah, blah, blah. But I don't know, you know, it's like, marijuana got legal and we didn't know if we were going to see people here in LA on every single street corner smoking pot. You might see that in Venice probably, but it's not really the case. You know, you don't, like, the people who want to do it, we're going to be doing it anyway. And maybe you'll have some new people that'll try it.
Right.
I don't know. right? I mean, it's kind of how it played out. Like, we haven't seen, like,
yeah, I mean, where it comes to rampant marijuana prohibition. But it's a little different, though, because I don't think that there are a lot of, like, pro argument. There are a lot of reasons.
Well, it's completely different.
For, like,
but the similarity is, like, if you want to do something, you're going to find a way to do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally. Totally. But where the government comes in is, like, I guess trying to prevent you from doing something that is, like, a net negative. Where right. Gambling seems to be like a net negative for everybody but the house. Like, I don't know many people.
Yeah.
I guess there are professional poker players, but that's a little different because that's almost like you're like an athlete. Like, you're playing a game. So I don't even really kind of consider that gambling. When I think of gambling, I think of like all the people that are just kind of feeding slot machines and losing a bunch of money on blackjack and games like that. So, because the other thing about gambling too is you can, unlike... So say like drugs, right? That's another area where like there's all this controversy around whether the government should have the ability to prevent people from doing drugs. I guess you can kind of like overdose and kill yourself in one instance of doing drugs, but like take something like alcohol. Like, it takes probably decades of being an alcoholic before your body starts to seriously fail or before you start to really have super negative health ramifications, like life-threatening health ramifications. Whereas gambling, I mean, you can lose everything in probably a night. Like, how many people go to Vegas and wind up losing their homes because they can't control their gambling in a week or something? So it, and the other thing too is that it's really predatory. Like, everything that like a casino does in designing those experiences is all about extracting, keeping you there and extracting as much money from you as possible. Even algorithms for slot machines are all sort of tweaked in order to keep you playing and losing money, but holding on to the hope that you'll be able to sort of win big, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's government regulation is always such an interesting thing, and how much they should be in our personal lives. I mean, on everything from can we bet on sports to do we have to wear a seatbelt? Like,
yeah.
Where should we be making our own decisions?
Speaking of which, I saw a headline that I thought you would be thrilled with. California is now requiring that all new homes have solar panel installations.
Shut the front door.
Yeah.
How did I not see this?
I don't know. I was like, oh, Miriam's gonna love this. I thought that I was gonna.
Miriam's gonna love this.
Yeah.
Not.
I think I'll see if I can find the article. But that
why?
I was like, this is unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
If they want to make laws like that, they should also send everyone a stipend for it. Like, here you go.
Yeah.
You have to have this, but you don't have to pay for it. I don't know.
So that's interesting. Well, I feel like so many people are just going to become so rich. If you are able to get an operation up and going in a state that suddenly makes sports gambling legal, like, and you are competitive in that marketplace, you will for sure become like super wealthy.
You know, I don't know how I didn't know about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's never too late, right? I mean, if we're
able. It's never too late. That's true.
Like, if you're somebody's probably right now. Where
now all the good domains are going to be gone.
Yeah.
We're going to have that problem.
I know. They just released the .app top-level domain name, and we're moving all of our URLs to .app.
What's up with that?
What do you mean?
Like, what is it supposed to imply? Like, you know, .org is an organization?
Yeah, I think it's probably supposed to imply that you're accessing some kind of app, but I think that .app, so .app, .com, .org, those are all called TLDs, or top-level domains. And I think .app is the first TLD to come along since .com that has a kind of brand recognition, and it's like a modern .com, basically. In the past couple of years, they've released all kinds of like crazy top-level domain names. So you can get like .agency, .works, .co, .cool, I mean, there's all these different things. But .app is the first one that comes along, and I feel like, wow, that feels kind of like professional and kind of like legit in a way that almost nothing else does. So I'm pretty excited about that.
It's interesting how this did happen, though, around the same time that esports is like exploding.
Yeah.
And how about these scholarships?
Yeah. I think these things are probably kind of connected. But yeah, so the idea that colleges are now starting to see esports as a great, as the future, I guess, is really how I would position that. And starting to give scholarships for it. It's not even a thing where it was like they're considering giving scholarships. I think that article said that esports scholarships were up like 140% or some kind of weird figure where it was like, not only do they already exist, but they're growing and becoming more of a thing. Amazing. Honestly, I think that traditional professional sports in America, like your football, baseball, et cetera, my generation is probably the last generation that is going to have any substantial fan base for those sports or people who pay mind to those things. I was listening to somebody recently talking about a conversation they had with a naval commander, and this naval commander has had to stop using sports analogies for everything because nobody knows what he's talking about when he's like, we got to run the ball to the end zone. People are like, what? They don't even know. They don't understand sports analogies because pro sports are boring. Like when you compare to video games where there are explosions and you're these crazy maps and terrains and you're playing with other people or even just watching them, there's just so much dynamic and immersive and interesting content that happens in games. Like I can't imagine a world where football beats Fortnite.
What's Fortnite? What's that about?
Fortnite's like it's the super popular game right now. Everybody's playing it, and it actually is really fun. I've played a couple of times. You basically just get dropped. It's like, first of all, it's a massively multiplayer online game, right? So like everybody kind of plays and dials in, and you're playing against other people. And what happens is, I guess the narrative is, I don't exactly understand what this sort of like story and narrative about all of this is, like why this is happening, but you start, you play rounds and everybody starts, it starts a group of people together in one round. Maybe it's like 50 people or 100 people all get sort of put together in a group and a round begins. And it opens up with like everybody's on this plane flying over a big island. And as the plane is flying over the islands, like at any point while it's going across the terrain, you can push a button to eject from the plane. So everybody drops down onto this island. I don't know how many people it is. Say it's 50 or 100. And then it's just a last man standing thing where everybody has to kill each other. And whoever is the last person standing wins.
What's up with the scholarship? Is it that accessible? Is it just that the number of people offering these scholarships has gone up significantly?
I think the story and the big idea here is more just about this is where things are going. The future big markets and big points of interest, esports are probably going to dominate the sort of like sporting world in another 5 or 10 years. You know, all like traditional American sports are the Facebook to kids Snapchat nowadays. And colleges are sensitive to this. They're like, they sense that change. They can see that people are dropping an interest in that and they see where it's going, and it's going to esports. And seeing that trend, they're starting to appeal to it. So it's smart. It's where the future is.
Okay, that's the future. Speaking of future, you know, it'd be really cool too to see. I mean, because like, what are they going to do with these football stadiums? You know, like these open spaces.
Something that
what does the future of that look like?
Yeah, this is another thing. I mean, if I had,
because we've been to these esports games. I mean, they're just up on a screen.
Yeah, what they need to do and where that's going to go, as soon as it becomes not cost prohibitive to do this, I think what's going to happen is they're just going to give everybody in a stadium like that VR goggles. The latest version of the Oculus Rift, for instance, I believe is a standalone unit. Like you don't need to plug it into a computer. So give it another 5 years or less, and I think the economics of those things will be such that like everybody will just go to those stadium to arenas and they'll sit down and they'll plug into VR, and then everybody will experience the event as if they were actually immersed in that world, and probably from the perspective of wherever they're sitting, you know. So it is almost indifferent to actually watching like a live sporting event. It'll feel exactly the same as that, and you'll even like, you know, which to me sounds like amazing. It would be like going to watch a Harry Potter Quidditch match or something. You know, it's like it's this fantastical thing that you didn't think was possible. I mean, think about it. Think about like whether, I mean, can you imagine if you went to a sports arena and sat down and put in a VR headset and then suddenly you've got dragons flying around and explosions happening everywhere and like all these crazy, what feels like you've just been transplanted to a fantastical world. That's going to be what happens. And can you imagine going from that back to like a bunch of guys running a leather ball back and forth down the field? I mean,
be hard to imagine. Well, in the meantime, they could at least put like a Fortnite game up at IPEX.
Yeah. Yeah, you would think so. You would think that movie theaters would be capitalizing on this. Give us like the luxury
esports experience.
Yeah, really. It is really surprising. I mean, you would think that like in an industry that's struggling as much as it is.
That theaters would be all about this, right? Theaters would be
all over it. I think it's going to happen. We still have to go to that VR thing too.
I know. Let's plan to do that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about hiring people.
Yeah. I've been...
Oh, the joys.
Yeah. It's tough, I think. It's probably one of the most important things you can do as a business owner is pull together a great team of people, but man, is it hard. And it's kind of a moving target. And I'm talking more about the perspective from a tech startup. I think Aaron Sorkin really hosed the tech industry with The Social Network, the movie, because so many people just have wild expectations for things like compensation and outcomes and the work that's involved in a business and startups and all that stuff. And so it is tough to find people who have the right mentality, who have a clear understanding or sort of get the game a little bit. And then making sure that they're sort of incented, that you're giving them the right incentives and the right compensation packages that can balance the needs of an early stage startup with the sort of long-term goals that individual people have. And then in the modern age, there are interesting constraints too. Like, do you want to hire people that are local, like that are in your city, that are locals that can come to a physical office? Or do you want to be remote? Or do you want to be both? And then managers have hiring managers have different priorities and needs, and employees or folks who are looking for work have different needs. And I thought that we could talk about some of those trade-offs and how to think about it from both sides of that table, and just dig into it a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, let's do it.
So one thing that I was kind of go back and forth on or think a lot about is this idea of having a remote company or a physical, like, in-person company where people are coming into the office at 9 a.m. and leaving at 5 or 6, and it's a much more structured and sort of traditional business workplace. I don't really have a comment, I think, in the general marketplace as to whether one is better than the other. I think that for some groups of people, a remote environment is great. I think for other types of people, that like a physical in-person thing is really great. For my own personal preferences, I like working remotely. I like working my own hours. I don't like a schedule or consistency, which drives some people I work with crazy. But I really do prefer the sort of remote lifestyle. And I think as time goes on, most
people would prefer that these days.
Yeah. You know, and I also read, I think Harvard, Business Review, or some Harvard-connected think tank, I guess, did a study recently about the effectiveness of remote employees versus, I guess, in-person employees. And folks who are allowed to work from home, remote's like a weird word to say, like working from home, basically, have much higher satisfaction, have fewer sick days, are more productive on the whole, work longer hours, like et cetera, et cetera. It seems that giving people the ability to kind of work from home improves the organizational output and the quality of life for everybody involved. So I'd be a strong advocate for remote, but I kind of want to have a mix. Like, I think that it is good to have a physical space for folks to utilize, especially because working from home, I mean, it's like you can get a little stir crazy for sure.
Sure.
And sometimes you have constraints. I mean, like you might be able to get a better internet connection in a commercial space. Like, there's all kinds of reasons to have a sort of physical location that people maybe have better equipment. Obviously, you want to have a meeting place. I think that meeting up in people's homes isn't optimal. I mean, you can do it, but...
Yeah, no, you want to have, like, a professional setting.
For a professional setting. Yeah, especially if you're trying to do, like business development or, like outside business development meetings. Like, you don't want to bring somebody you're trying to get into a partnership with you to your home to do a meeting. Oh, yeah, just move that dirty laundry off my bed and I'll give you this presentation here. So that's not a good thing. This is also, I think, structurally... from the perspective of the workforce, like, structurally it's changing in that everybody's a freelancer nowadays. Like, how many, nobody like works for somebody else, it seems, anymore, or fewer people do today than they did at least before. And so, environments like co-working spaces definitely have been thriving. Mm-hmm. So hiring, for remote versus local, I think remote first is a great way to approach it. I certainly love living that way. I like working my own hours. I don't like having to be at a certain place at a certain time ever. And I think that most people appreciate that as well. And frankly, it gives you so much more. There are so many advantages to broadening your search for talent to beyond just like what's available in a 20-mile radius or whatever, being able to hire the best person wherever they might be, especially because I live in the west side of Los Angeles. To have like the cost of living here is astronomical, basically. And so like to hire somebody who's going to do this for their full-time gig, like you have to pay them a market salary that is competitive with what like Snapchat and Google are offering here, which is tough. Which
doesn't work with a startup.
it's a little tougher, And so to be able to hire remotely, I mean, you can hire somebody in the middle of the country who has the same or better skill sets and isn't needing that same payout in order to just like live.
Yeah, you're opening up your talent pool significantly.
And I think the key to running a remote first organization really is about just using the right tools and being very conscious of the constraints that having everybody be disconnected kind of present. We use Basecamp, and I love it more and more every day because, first of all, the software itself, it's project management software. And the team behind it is so thoughtful in not just making a tool that's easy to use and organized well and all that stuff, but in designing it with a philosophy about running a remote company and running a company in not a chaotic way. And everything that Basecamp does with their software and their books, and they do a lot of podcasts and all kinds of great stuff, but it's always about reducing stress, reducing distractions, making it easier for people to focus and work on what they're good at and all of that stuff. And so Basecamp is a great tool for running a remote company and keeping track of who's needing to accomplish what, and as a hub of communication, better than email, better than anything else, I think. So we make really heavy use of that. We use AngelList for recruiting. At least the last couple of people that I hired came through AngelList, and they're phenomenal. And in fact, one of them is remote in Portland, and it's been working out really great. So I think that AngelList is a good place for recruiting. We use Google and Gmail, like Google Apps, for our email and stuff like that. So those are some tools. I don't know that there's anything else. I mean, we recently implemented Intercom, but that's less of like a hiring thing and more of a marketing thing. But shout out to those guys because they have an amazing product. Okay, so anyway, moving beyond remote versus local and some of the tools that we use, I thought it'd be helpful to talk about some things to think about as a manager and then some things to think about as an employee. As I brought on some of these folks that joined Onward recently, something that I learned over and over again over the past year is that you've really got to do a lot of work to set expectations with people. The sooner the better, and certainly before you really begin to dive into any serious kinds of work. And then I also think that part of those expectations when you're hiring somebody or just starting to work with them is that you ought to start with a kind of trial period or a probationary period or working on a small project together before making long-term commitments to somebody, like putting together a compensation package and all the rest of it, because it's really important, I think, to get a sense of what it actually feels like to collaborate on a real-life project before really getting into like, okay, how do you fit into this organization and how's the org gonna compensate you for that? I like to, and this is pretty easy to do if you're talking about design or engineering, because you can kind of just pick a small bite-sized project to work on together. And if it goes well, then you've got a good candidate. And if it doesn't go well, then you've got a little bit more work to do. That's kind of what I think about in terms of hiring. Do you have anything else that you wanted to add to that from a sort of managerial perspective?
Yeah, of course, setting expectations is huge and worth every ounce of time you spend doing it, because it does take time, but it'll help you in the long run.
What are the sort of what areas of expectations do you think are important to set?
Well, of course, it can vary, right, from project to project and even employee to employee. But whatever is required for success in the company, in what you're trying to accomplish as a goal. If being on time, for example, was required, how important is it really to be on time? In some cases, right, say like an emergency situations like paramedics or a hospital, or, you know, I could see how that would be extremely important. And so you set those expectations.
Or even just being the barista at my coffee shop at 9 in the morning when I get there. It's really, really important to me that person shows up.
It's really important to us that they're on time.
Critical, but one might say.
In your case, right, if you're hiring an engineer, it doesn't matter. No. It doesn't matter if they show up at 9 a.m., right?
Yeah.
You know, because your project is probably based on a deadline. And so really, you're just going to be setting expectations around the goals of your company.
And like that role specifically, and how like expectations around how that role fits into the company's overall goals.
Yeah. You know, whatever they need to do in order to get the greatest impact for their role.
What level of nitpickiness do you think is called for when it comes to this type of stuff? A good example that I was dealing with recently was like one opening for chaos in Basecamp is that anybody can create a to-do item and assign it to somebody else. And if you don't control for that and have a system for like how things get assigned, how they convert from like this is an idea to now this is a sort of task that somebody needs to complete, if you don't really control for that process, people will just like assign a gajillion to-dos to everybody else on the team.
You're not going to think of everything right away when you're setting expectations, especially, and again, we're speaking about the frame of references for startups, okay? So it'd be very different in a established company because you'd have a manager, for example, that would be in charge of assigning to-dos, right? Perhaps, but it's just very different in a startup. There's a lot more potential for chaos. Mm-hmm. So, but having said that, it all comes back to what are your goals and what are you trying to achieve, and then setting appropriate expectations for that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously avoiding chaos in a potentially more chaotic environment is super important, right? And so whatever you need to do to mitigate that and set those kinds of expectations up front, like how you addressed it when it became an issue, right? But you immediately addressed it, and then you set up some processes for that. That's a great way of handling it. I love that you assign or work on a bite-sized project when you have a new engineer.
Yeah. And it's not just engineering. Like, I recently hired a phenomenal sales and customer support guy, and he's just killing it. But I didn't know, when we first started working together, I didn't know what, I had high hopes, but I didn't know whether he'd be able to do the job, whether this was a good fit. He was clearly a really good salesperson, clearly good at this stuff, but another big piece of that compatibility factor is like, does this person work well with me or the rest of the team? And so we just did like a handful of calls together, basically. I said, all right, let's get together on Monday and we'll go through some of this list and just kind of get a feel for whether, you know, just get the vibe on it, really. And we sat down and we went through a few of these things and I kind of had him handle a lot of it, and he just crushed it. So kind of being able to see him do it and see how he interacted with customers and how it went was all that I needed in order to make a longer term plan with him, not just in terms of like comp, but also like what are you going to do for the company kind of thing. But all of it was really just based on doing a handful of those calls together. And each of those things were, you know, with an engineer, doing a bite-sized project with an engineer, if it doesn't go well, it doesn't really matter because you just delete the code and you move on and nobody knows any differently. But like, when you're putting somebody out there to interact with customers, it's a bit more of like an outward facing thing. So it's a little higher risk, but each of those individual conversations were, you know, if we lost that customer because some disastrous thing, or we lost that lead, I should say, because of some disastrous thing that happened in a conversation, that wouldn't have killed the business or ruined us or whatever. So they're a little more higher impact, but still bite-sized and for the most part inconsequential in the individual project or the individual conversation, whether it went well or not. But yeah.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's the perfect thing to do, especially in the startup world, but in any kind of situation, during this trial period, it's a great thing to do.
I'm surprised that's not really a more common practice. Is it a standard practice to give new employees like a probationary period? Is that common or uncommon?
Probationary periods are very common. Projects during probationary periods, maybe not as common.
Do people get paid for probationary periods?
Yes.
Okay.
Most of the time.
I guess that's good.
There are exceptions, but yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And sometimes at a lower, it depends on the employee and their experience. I mean, we're not talking about CEOs, right? I mean, because you can't, like, you have to offer them a compensation package just to get them to walk in your door.
Right.
But, you know, so it depends on the level of the employee.
Yeah.
But yeah, setting expectations, super important. And not just setting expectations on what you expect from them, but on how you expect them to interact with you and how you behave.
Yeah.
For example, one thing I like to do with new employees is make sure that they're clear that they need to communicate with me and how they need to communicate with me. Like if I'm in my computer and you're asking me a question and I'm like, and you don't have my attention, I didn't agree to it. So you better make sure you have my attention.
I don't think that'll hold up in court.
Well, again, like that's why you set the expectation though. Like, so they know, because then if they come to you and they want, you know, to get something done and you're like, and like, you know, so let's talk about, I mean, we talked a little bit about freelancers and how everyone seems to be a freelancer nowadays, but you do still have situations where you need salaried employees.
Yep.
So let's talk about freelancers versus salaried.
Yeah.
In the startup situation, is everyone basically a freelancer right now that you've hired?
Kind of. I guess that really everybody that's involved right now is a mix of all these things, basically. Like some are getting paid hourly. Like design, for instance, we pay on an hourly basis because there's not around the clock 24 hours design work to be done. Sales and customer support, we pay a base for, and then we do commission and then equity. And then, or equity is on the table. And then for engineering, it's equity and an hourly as well. So nobody is really salaried yet. But we certainly want to move in that direction, I think. Something that's kind of, and the other part of it too is that when, and this is something that everybody, like both sides of the table, really have to think about, like management and those who are, you know, like employees. But how do you balance in an offering for like a longer term or just ongoing engagement? How do you balance salary versus performance based comp versus equity? And where should people put those priorities? As an employee, as a manager, like it really comes down to the company's financial position, I think, is probably going to be the largest determining factor in like how you balance those things out. But as an employee or as somebody who's seeking work in the modern world, I personally would index on immediate performance-based compensation. And this is kind of how I've explained salary versus performance-based comp versus equity to these guys that I've been bringing on, is that like basically the way to think about this is that you got three cups in front of you, three empty cups. You got salary, equity, and performance-based comp. And then you've got this big jug of compensation juice, and you can basically divide that jug of juice up between those three cups. And you can put all of it into equity, which means that you're going to get paid 100% in equity. You could put all of it in salary, which means that you get paid 100% in salary. Or you could divide it up into different cups at different amounts. So if you put a lot in equity, there's not as much left for salary or performance-based compensation. If you put a lot in salary, there's not as much for equity, et cetera.
It's a great example.
Yeah, because it's finite. There's a finite amount of like compensation a company can give you. And I think, again, back to this whole idea of like how badly Aaron Sorkin hosed us, a lot of people are fixated on equity. In startups and in sort of startup comp, a lot of people are obsessed about equity because they think that's the path to becoming, you know, Zuckerberg or whatever. But if I was out looking for a job and I just wanted to like make money and I wasn't trying to build something impactful, like there wasn't a sort of ideological motivation. It was just like, I gotta make money. I got family and mortgage and all that stuff. I feel like most people who are looking to join startups or get involved in that life are probably also people who feel that they can generate a lot of value. And so the thing about equity is it's totally illiquid, and it's like the chances of you actually converting that into real like value, to like turn your equity into dollars and a substantial amount of dollars, has got to be close to like lottery odds. You know, we all read about the 23-year-old kid who's now a billionaire, or even like that guy, is his name David Cho? It's that guy who like Facebook paid in stock to do a graffiti portrait in their offices. Like in one of the early offices, this guy, he was like a graffiti artist, and Facebook wanted like a mural done in the office, but they didn't have enough cash to pay him his cash rate, so they gave him stock. And then like 5 or 10 years later or whatever, that stock turned into $500 million. and so we hear these stories and people are like, "All my ticket to this is just to have equity in a firm." But for every story like that, there are probably 5,000 people or 5,000 deals, equity deals, where people just got hosed in one of the 1,000 ways that you can get hosed out of your equity or your sort of like what you think that means, especially in a startup situation. Like the only value to me that equity, I mean, if you like, let's acknowledge and set aside the fact that it might turn into something giant and you might cash out. That is a possibility, but it's very remote and unlikely. So beyond that, I mean, the value of equity in a firm has to generally do with like governance and your say in the things that are going on. And so to me, like equity really, the only people that really benefit from equity are like the founders of a company. Whereas if you're getting paid in cash today, you can pay your rent with cash. You can take a pretty girl out on a date with cash. You can't pay rent with equity. I've tried. It doesn't work. Like you can't, you know. And so the things that you can kind of do, so when it comes to like getting cash today out of a startup, right, like almost no startup has baller style salary money to pay you. Unless they're like funded, right? But even then, so you're unlikely to negotiate an amazing salary for yourself, which leaves performance-based compensation. What do you think about that topic of equity versus salary versus commission? Like, where do you think people should focus for those things?
Well, in a startup?
In general, but yeah, in a startup.
Well, unfortunately, it's not so black and white that we can put it in a general perspective, because a company that's already established that has that's on the market, like on the stock market, where there's real, like that equity is real at that point already.
No, but it's
the company.
But this is the thing. It's not though. I mean, I know personally several Twitter folks who came into Twitter after they were super funded, super huge, super big, and all that stuff, where they had the money and they have the equity and all that, and they were paid in, you know, they had significant stock options, but the strike price of those, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but let's say the strike price of those options was like $15 and Twitter has been trading at $10. Like all those people got equity from an established company that that was on a good trajectory, you know, and still a good company today, but who are hosed in terms of equity compensation.
Again, it still depends, because if you're the CEO and you're coming into a company in that scenario you described, and you agree on the 15 or whatever the price is when you come in, you're banking on the value you're going to bring, that stock price is going to go up. Yeah. And if it doesn't and it goes down, you're kind of responsible, but it can go both ways. So I would never give the same advice to an executive that I would like someone in a startup situation.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I'm thinking more of like rank and file. Like executive stuff gets, it's really different when you start talking about executive compensation, because executives have an inordinate amount of ability to drive the direction of an organization.
Yeah, it depends on your impact, right? How much impact are you able to have on that organization?
Exactly.
But in a startup, you know, I agree with a lot of what you said. Your equity is nothing until the company sells, and the chances of the company selling,
like lottery.
Like playing the lottery.
And it's straight up lottery odds for a thing to get to the outcome that you want. I mean, because companies, like the company could sell, but it could sell at like nothing. It could sell for $100 or something, you know, or it could go out of business, or a founder could have a meltdown and drag the whole thing down with it. I mean, it's just there are so many ways that a company can fail. It's astonishing. Yeah.
But so equity means nothing until the company sells, and then it means something at that point. But whether that something is a positive or negative is also another variable. On the other hand, again, depending on the role, because in a startup situation, you actually have the ability to have a lot of impact depending on what you were hired for.
Right.
And so if you're coming in and you're taking on a huge role and you have a huge impact on the outcome of that company, well, then in that case, you probably want to have some equity, because if you do get to that finish line, will be worth something.
Yeah.
But what that amount is also, but you know, that depends.
Yeah.
So that's how I feel about equity.
Thanks for tuning in. For more information, head over to foxhole.fm. That's foxhole.fm. If you have any questions, please email us at feedback@foxhole.fm. And if you're enjoying what you hear, please leave us a great review on your favorite podcast platform or iTunes. Thanks again for listening.